Welcome to Let's Chat Parenting, a podcast for parents who want to be in the know. Hi, I'm Jared Jones. I'm the Director of Student Ministries at Orangewood Church, located in Orlando, Florida. This month, we have a recording from one of our Let's Chat Live events. We had Dr. Jim Cofield come and speak to our parents. Jim is a licensed mental health therapist in the Orlando area. He's also a professor at Reformed Theological Seminary located in Orlando, Florida. He is the director of the counseling program there and also the director of the Oviedo Counseling Clinic. And he came to share some of the information and ideas that he has recently put down in a book that he co-authored called Shaping Your Family Story, How Imperfect Parents Create Hope and Promise for Their Children. It was a great night. He had some amazing things to say, and we cannot wait to share it with you.
It's good to be here. The crowd goes wild. Thank you. I think the real reason I was chosen is next month they're going to be talking about failure and challenges and celebrating in failure, and so they wanted someone to come and just fail well. So next time they can go and say, "Well, remember what happened last time," and then go from there. Here's what tonight will not be. This is not going to be a time for someone who thinks they know a lot and knows more than anyone else kind of telling you how to parent. I think parenting is a dance of terror and privilege, and I don't think there are experts on parenting. I think there's people that just maybe a little ahead of you on the journey, but parenting is very difficult, and the kids, you know, you think you get it right with the first one, and you say, okay, that's the formula. And then your next child comes along, and that formula just doesn't work. And then you realize that maybe we're not that formulaic at all. And so what I'd like us to think about in terms of parenting, if we could, is the idea of telling a better story with our lives and with our families. I'm amazed at how everybody is compelled and is incredibly faithful to a good story. My oldest son is autistic. His name's Skyler. And Skyler loves Star Trek, Star Wars, that sort of stuff. And he gets kind of obsessed. That's part of his autism. And he's 28 and will forever be 7. And so every year there are different conventions here in Orlando. I mean, there's, you know, MegaCon and Comic-Con. And, well, my favorite one a few years ago was the Star Wars convention. And 33,000 people came from all over the U.S. dressed as Wookiees and you know, X-Wing fighter people and all that sort of stuff. And so Skyler and I went, and he was just amazed. His eyes were wide open in a way that, matter of fact, I probably saw more joy in those moments in his life, as he was then looking around, than most of us live in our lives when we say we have joy in Christ, when we really... we really don't know how to even live that out. But he was just amazed. And it was a sea of mental illness. I mean, you could go like this, and you would touch crazy everywhere you went. I mean, there was, and by the way, Star Wars, good story, told well, still around for all these generations, 30-some years later. Remember, I'm going to age myself here, but when it first came out, it was pretty controversial. There was the Jabba the Hutt was that kind of character that I'm trying to look like, and Princess Leia was in a pretty skimpy bikini. She was, and it was kind of a little bit scandalous back then. But I just want to tell you, 35 years after the fact, at the Orange County Convention Center, more people looked like Jabba the Hutt than they did like Princess Leia. It was a pretty nasty situation, but it was amazing. There were you could get married. And by either the dark side or the light side, you just had to declare that and you'd go up and get married. People were getting tattoos, permanently making vows with ink and blood with Star Wars characters. My favorite moment took place. Skyler and I sat down to eat, and we were eating, and across from us there were two men who were just angry with each other. They were obviously arguing, and they were just livid, just at it. And you could, and so, you know, whenever you're at a place like that, you kind of want to listen, you know, and see what's going on. And so we're kind of listening to it, and they're arguing about whether an X-Wing fighter could go into hyperspace. And so they were going, no, it can't, it can't. And then they're going, how would it get to Tatooine if it can't? And it's going to, it was brought there on a transport. And they were arguing about two things that didn't exist. And I thought, oh, this is just crazy. But I was amazed as I looked around at how so many people are compelled and faithful to a story that touches them or a story that engages them. And I think why my kids sometimes aren't as excited as about the gospel as I'd like them to be. And sometimes when I find my kids more interested in things that don't matter than things that I think that do, I wonder, what is it? And I think if I'm honest, sometimes the story that I'm telling in my family, the story that we're living, is not a very compelling story sometimes. Sometimes I kind of feel like we inoculated our kids to the gospel. And my kids are older now than all of yours. But you know, when you get a flu shot, what you do is you give somebody just enough of the flu so that when the real flu comes along, it's built up an immunity to it. And sometimes I think we do that in our families. We try, but we're tired. We kind of drag them to church, but we're kind of tired. Our own lives are not quite what we would hoped. And we almost inoculate them to the very things that really stir us the most and we want to. It's almost as if we've given them just enough of the gospel to where the real gospel shows up and they seem to be immune to it. And so I'd like us to think about together the idea of what would it be like if we kind of saw our families as a story, as a movie, as a novel. And we broke down our families and broke down our parenting with kind of the basic categories of novel, of setting and character and plot and conflict and all those sort of things, and just talked about making each of those elements a little bit better in our family. And so if you can kind of just stick with me, that's kind of the idea I'd like us to go with. And if you have a question in the middle of this, just raise your hand. I have three kids, Skylar, Kim, and Pierce, and I'm a little bit, I'm far from an expert on parenting, but for most of you, a little further down the path. I mean, my kids are all in their early 20s. Skylar's my oldest at 28. He's kind of forever seven, so that at least puts me in the category with some of you. But I really want to just think with you out loud about the idea of telling a better story with our lives, with our parenting. So with that as kind of a beginning spot, let me tell you why I think it's cool that the church and Orangewood School, which is also a Christian school, are serious about parenting. Because God's kind of serious about parenting. And what do I mean by that? I think most of us want to figure out what are the 5 or 10 things I should do, and then my kids will turn out perfect. I probably went into counseling. I probably went into this field to see what everybody else did wrong, and so that I wouldn't do that with my own kids. Didn't work out very well. That's just not the reason you ought to do a job. But I remember when I first started, when I was kind of young in this field, and a family would come in and they'd tell me that, you know, their kid just turned out squirrely, and I'd kind of make a note and say, what'd they do wrong? Because I'm not going to do that. And boy, how arrogant, how lost I was to think that that's what I would do. Now, I would want to suggest to you that all of us want to do a good job with our kids. We love our kids. But it is a little mysterious. Some drug addicts' kids become missionaries. And some missionaries' kids become drug addicts. I'm not sure I understand why that always works. I was so sure that I would figure it out and come up with the right formula and then my kids would all turn out okay. And my kids have turned out fine in spite of me. But it's not a formula that you can plug kids into. It's more dynamic, and that's why I kind of talk about it as a story. Why is God so into this deal of parenting? Well, theologically, there's two basic questions about the nature of God. Is God holy, righteous, and just? Is God gracious, kind, and merciful? I mean, that's the big theological questions. I mean, churches split over that. God was just saying, yes, that is a big deal if you're paying attention. Thank you, Lord, for being with us in this conversation. Those are the big questions, right? I mean, even other religions, that's their question about deity. Is, you know, what is the nature of God? And the nature of God in most churches say, we handle that really well. Most churches say, you know, we handle that tension between God's holiness and God's goodness pretty well. The truth would say only about 20% of the churches handle that really, that balance in a very balanced way. You think, what's this got to do with parenting? What? Well, the reason I think God is so into parenting is those are the two basic questions of the human soul about the nature of God. And those are the two basic questions every kid is always asking. Do you love me? And are there consequences for my behavior? Those are two questions that every kid is always asking those two questions in an age-appropriate way. They're asking the very nature of God questions. That's why it's a big deal. Every kid is always saying, do you love me? And then they're saying, will you say no to me? Those are the two questions. Are there consequences to my behavior? That answers a theological question of God's holiness, righteousness. And do you love me? Is there mercy, grace, and love for me? If you're going to err on one side or the other, I would suggest that you err on the side of grace, because Jesus and Paul's theology is both criticized for being too grace-based. However, the truth is, we're invited to live in both of those things. We're invited to live in the tension. And churches do that. Churches are supposed to do that. They're supposed to present both. We all know churches that kind of go off one side or the other, right? I mean, we've all seen churches that have gone off the rails. And I mean, the only lane on their track is God's holy, God's righteous, you know, don't mess up. You better not screw up because God is watching, you know, and there's a great cloud of witnesses watching you and your holiness and righteousness is, and we all know churches like that. And we all know some churches, it's like, it doesn't matter who you are, what to do. Oh, you just, you know, we just, you know, it just, it's okay. Let me just pat you on the head. Everything's okay. We all know churches like that. We kind of go, well, you know, no, I think we're supposed to behave. And no, I don't think we're supposed to be legalistic and angry. I think there's a tension that a church is supposed to live in. And I would suggest there's a tension that a family is supposed to live in, answering those two questions all the time. So that's why parenting books don't work, because most parenting books will fall off one side or the other. And what happens is the parents that fall off this side, kids need structure, kids need discipline, kids need to understand authority, we're not going to be inconvenienced for our kids. They need to be inconvenienced for us. The parents on this side find books that tell them that's the right way to parent. And they usually find other parents who agree with them on that's the right way to parent. And then they talk about how bad other parents are, and they get their information in kind of an echo chamber of make sure they know who's boss, and that's their deal. And then there's the people over here, and they're kind of going, and they're talking about attachment all the time, and then the furthest extreme of this is the family bed, you know, we're not going to kick our child out into, we're just all going to be in the same bed until they're ready, you know. And then, you know, there's an 11-year-old, you know, going, you know, here I am in bed. You go, I think maybe it's time. I think it's time for you. But, it's like we never say no, because all we do, we need to attach, we need to connect. And I gave an extreme example of both. But you know what they do? They tend to find parents who parent like them. And it's kind of wild. And this, you know, the cool thing or the interesting thing about the principals at Orangewood, the staff and the counseling department there, I'll bet you if they, you got them really honest, it probably had to be really late at night when they were really, really tired. They could probably almost tell the parents And then some parents are coming and going, I can't believe you guys have these rules about this. Well, that's parents on this side. And then they'll be coming and going, I can't believe you let these kids just get away with everything. I saw a kid in jeans. What are you doing? And, you know, it's like, you know, and it drives them crazy, you know, and they sit and they talk to the parents. They go, well, I'm so sorry that, you know, because, but the truth is, I don't give any parents advice till I figure out which side they're on. I don't. I mean, people call me because I'm a psychologist. And they'll be like, our kid was caught drunk driving. What should we do? I don't know their kid. I don't know the details, but usually what I'll say is something like, well, what are you thinking about doing? We're going to, I just want to leave him there for the next 2 weeks and just let him see what it's like to live in prison, you know, and then. And so chances are, if that's their attitude, what side are they on? They're over here, justice, holiness. And to that parent, I'll say, why don't you just go pick them up? Tell them that we'll talk about it later. If they go, well, I can't believe they just pick on these high school kids. These cops, we've already hired him a lawyer. He's not going to pay a price for this. I mean, they're trying to mess his life up. We're going to fight this. To that one, I want to say, you know, maybe you ought to let them spend the night, because they need to be pushed this way, and they need to be pushed this way. And so, the first thing I want you to do before we talk about how to write your family story, I want you to kind of be honest about where you think you land. And now let me just say one other thing. You're usually horrible at self-evaluation in this. Because most of us will say, well, we're perfect. We live in the balance. But you probably don't. Ask somebody. Ask some friends. Hey, listen, we had this kind of crazy guy talking about parents that fall off the side of too much structure or too much nurture. That's kind of the two issues. And he was trying to say we should be balanced. Where do you think we are? Because I want to tell you, if you're not careful, people will get all their information in an echo chamber that validates their wrong strategies. I do it all the time. I'm looking for somebody to tell me what I'm doing is right. I'm still wanting someone to tell me that buffalo wings actually helps you lose weight. But I haven't had anyone validate that yet, but I'm waiting. I'm sure it's out there. There's got to be a study somewhere. I'm just going to keep looking. So the first thing I would just say to you tonight is, as we think about parenting, think about your family style. Think about the setting, if we were to talk about a story, the setting of your family. Is it a justice family? Kids know whatever you do, you don't break a rule. Or is it a gracious family that is so gracious that it falls off two sides and the kids don't have any discipline or anything? See, the biggest theological questions don't take place in a church, don't take place usually in the pulpit. They take place in the nursery, where this kind of plays out. A new mother hands her little baby over to the nursery workers and says, now if they cry, come get us. We'll be sitting in such and such a row. And then they come back after the church, kids been crying the whole time, and that lady and said, why didn't you get us? And they'll say, oh, kids just need to cry. And that was really a theological question of, do people need grace or do people need structure? Do kids need to be told no or do kids need to be told yes? Now, here's what's kind of crazy. In some families, the father's one and the mother's the other. That's not a good plan. When that starts happening, what you have is the father who thinks, you know, we'll just say it's a father, it could be either one that goes over this side, says, I've got to make up for the fact that she's given too much grace. And the grace person says, I've got to make up for the fact that he's just a piece of work. And that creates an incredible tension. And even though in one way that family is in balance, they're in balance in a way that is not healthy, because the kids then begin to play that against them, because they kind of know who to go to for whatever they need. The goal of children, if you didn't know this, maybe you, the goal of children is to manipulate adults. If you haven't figured that out yet, you're going to be terribly disappointed. You know, you think their goal is to love you. No, that's not true. They will love you eventually later, but at first they want to manipulate you to get what they want. You know, what's the Bible say about that? The Bible says that we're born foolish. And And that we're supposed to be, and good parenting helps kids become wise. And the reason parenting is so hard is that all of us are still foolish. I'm still foolish. So are you. Foolishness would be defined as my way is the best way. Wisdom might be defined as God's way is the best way. And I still sometimes believe my way is the best way. And I'm supposed to somehow help my kid get that. Does that make sense? All right, so point number one in our 72-point series on how to write a better story is, what's the setting like in your story? What's the setting? Is it a justice-based setting or a grace-based setting? And it's supposed to be a tension between the two. I've never heard a legalistic person say that they're too legalistic. I've never heard a grace-based person say they're too grace-based. So you may need some help kind of figuring this out. You know, what does our family tend to do? Is everybody afraid? Or is everybody not interested? You know, because they'll kind of give you those two places. Does that make sense? All right. Now, we could spend a lot more time on the different categories, but the way we're going to think about this together is we're going to talk about story. And the elements of a good story would be characters, plot, setting, conflict, and theme. I mean, if you were, you know, a good English teacher would tell us that that's what makes up a good story. And a story is essentially, a story is you've got a character who has to go through some sort of conflict to get what they want. And a good family story is, I want my kids to be raised with integrity and well, and we have to go through the conflicts to get it. And so it's got the elements of a good story in it. So we just talked for just a second about setting. And setting is the backdrop. And so when I think of the backdrop of a kid, I think at least in terms of what's the backdrop of the family. Does that make sense? We could talk a whole lot more about setting, but we've only got 6 hours together. They said to have you out by midnight, so I want to make sure we do that. So let's talk about character for a minute. Don't you hate it when you try to come in real quietly? And you were being so gracious. And then the door just, and everybody goes, like squirrel. That's it. So let's talk about the idea of character for a minute. You know, the verse that's often quoted is from Proverbs, where it says, "Raise up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart." That's been translated lots of different ways. Let me tell you what Bruce Waltke, who's an Old Testament theologian that was at RTS for a few years, just smarter than just any 10 people you ever met. We were talking about that verse one day, and he said, it's not bad the way most people try to interpret it. Most people try to interpret it, I'm from East Tennessee, and in East Tennessee, the way they'd interpret that is they'd say, well, our kids are just raising hell right now, but we took him to church every single Sunday. And we raised him up in the way he should go. And that means no matter how bad he is now, he's going to end up back at church. And that's basically how that was interpreted, at least in East Tennessee, where I'm from. I'm not sure that that's how Bruce Waltke saw it, who understands Hebrew. But he suggested that a way to understand that verse is the first phrase where it says, raise up, talking about raising up a child, comes from a Hebrew word that the same root word there is the word that they would use for a midwife when an infant is born that tries to create a desire for an infant to suck. And so he would say that one way to interpret that passage or the way that's written is when you raise up a child in a way that would make them thirsty, that would make them, you know, create a desire, raise our children in a way that creates a desire, a curiosity. And then he said the phrase, in the way he should go, is a phrase that would often be understood by the Hebrew people that would have been reading that for the first time, the way that a reed bends in the wind. the way that it's wired, the way that it's meant. And so there's a way in which one way to see that verse, and there's multiple interpretations, but in this, and Bruce would say that this is just one layer of a very complex and powerful verse. But one way to see that verse would be to say, raise your children in a way that creates a desire, and raise them based on the way that they're wired, on their temperament. Raise them based on the way that they're bent. And if you understand their bent and you raise to that way, they will be faithful to that. They'll grow. They'll, you know, the reed will keep growing if you understand how it bends. So that's not the only way to interpret that passage, but with that as just kind of a beginning place to think about the idea of character, a good director of a play, a good director of a movie becomes really, really a student of the character. And it's the characters that give the flavor. And there's lots of ways to talk about character. And I'm not a big fan of all the little psychological tests. I mean, some of them are okay, but you know, whether or not you're a golden retriever or an aardvark or a possum or a otter, or, you know, but, or whether you're ESFTJY or whatever, all those things. But what makes those interesting, the wrong way to use those tests are the way they're usually used. They're usually used as, well, just get over it, I'm an aardvark. That's the way I am. That's just who I am. I'm an otter. And as an otter, that's just the way I am. So, you know, love me, the otter. Or I'm an ENFP, and so that's just the way I am. I actually worked for a company once that had the Myers-Briggs temperament scales on our office doors. And it would be Dr. Jim Cofield, ENFP. And Dr. So-and-so, ISTJ. And it was like, really? I mean, that's how we're going to understand this? But what's helpful about those things is the reason that we ought to be interested in those sort of things is because if we want to raise up a child in the way he should go, the way she should go, based on their temperament, you've got to be a student of their traits, of their character. I'll give you an example. My youngest son is an introvert. You might have guessed that I'm not. And if you know anything about introverts and extroverts, if you don't know what an extrovert's been thinking, you haven't been listening because they've been telling you. For an introvert, they need time to figure out what they want to say. I mean, I'm an extrovert. I don't even know what I'm going to say till I'm halfway through the sentence. And we have fights in our house, and I'll say, there's three things we need to do, when I really only have two. But I'm going to come up with that third thing, and I don't want to be in a box. I want to be able to go ahead and say my third thing. And so Mona now will go, when I say something, I'll say, well, there's three things. And she'll go, what are they? Well, okay, there's two, you know, because I didn't have them. I was just going to come up with it because that's what extroverts do. That's not what introverts do. Introverts need time to think about their answer. Pierce was probably 14 years old before I figured out that was half of our problem when I would discipline him. He'd do something that didn't bother me, and he was like, you'd better have an answer for your daddy. I think I was a little better than that, but it was like, so what's wrong? Can't got your tongue? Come on, what's wrong? What do you do? You got a fight with your brother? Let's hear about it. What's wrong? And he's just, you know, going, well, dad, what's wrong? What's wrong? You can't talk because it's not the truth. You know, and it's like, well, that's just not understanding the way he's wired. And finally, and I'm embarrassed to say that, I mean, I'm a psychologist, and it wasn't until he was like 14 that I go, I don't think this is working. Because usually, you know, when something doesn't work, you know, usually we just try the same thing we did harder. You know, like when, you know, you put in a dollar into the Coke machine, and if nothing comes out, you don't go, let's rethink this. What you do is you go, well, I didn't hit the button hard enough. I'll just bang the button, and then you're, and so I just, that's how I parented. And then finally, I kind of got the sense that what he needed from me was to say, you know, you did this, you did that. I'd like to go to your room. I'm going to come in there in about 5 minutes. I need to know what's going on. It was amazing how much more articulate he was after he had 5 or 6 minutes to be an introvert thinking about his life instead of being forced to be an extrovert. Another way, and it's just helpful to know your kids' temperaments and to kind of be curious about it, just so that you can parent well. My kids, two of them, live in the moment. I mean, they live in the present. I live in the future. I mean, our house can be burning down, and I'm going to be talking about, you know, I mean, I'm always talking about what the possibilities are. If you're into the Myers-Briggs, I'm a high N. Two of my kids are high S's, which, if you don't know what that means, it doesn't matter. It's not that important. It's just it means I'm an idealist, and they tend to be realists. I would say that means they're pessimists, and I'm an optimist, but that's... But that created all sorts of problems with my kids. I was like, well, where are we going to go? Have you decided where you're going to go in college? You know, Dad, I'm in the eighth grade. Well, it's not too early. It's not too early for us to plan. And he's just going, I'm trying to get through today. If we're going to write a good story, if we're going to write a good family story, you got to be aware of the setting. Are you too justice-based or too grace-based? If you're going to write a good story, you've got to become, as the director of the play, the producer, you've got to become a student of the characters. What are they like? What do they want? What drives them? What are they hoping for? Sometimes we really miss our kids because we don't think about that. No daughter of mine's going to wear that outside. If you wanted to get a job as a stripper, you'd have to get more clothes on than that. You ever have conversations like that with your child? Now, you're right. They shouldn't wear those clothes out. But what would it be like to just be curious about what it is they long for? What if what they long for is, I want attention, and I want people to notice me, and that's not bad. Is it possible to validate the goodness of that and still say, but that's not how we're going to get attention? I mean, is it possible to say to the kid who's sad because he struck out, because he wanted to be the hero, and instead he's the goat? Instead of saying, well, just suck it up, because some days you win and some days you lose, son. I wonder what it'd be like to say, to validate the longing. Yeah, there's something right about wanting to really make a difference. But hitting a home run is not the kind of difference that will really echo into life the way you want. But yeah, it makes sense. Is there a way to validate those longings? You can't do that unless you're aware of their longings and aware of their temperament and aware of their personalities. Now, if this sounds like, well, you're just going to let them get away with anything, aren't you? No. Wrong strategies, deep longings. It's true for all of us as adults. Most of the problem with us is not our deep longings. Most of our problems with us is our wrong strategies. As it says in Jeremiah 2, my people have committed two sins. They've turned their back on me, the source of living water, and they've dug for themselves broken cisterns that don't hold water. It's a picture of people in a desert. What that verse does not say is, my people have committed a sin, they are thirsty in a desert. God does not chastise his people for their longings. He chastises them for their wrong strategies. So what it would be like to know our kids well enough to kind of know what it is they're longing for, what it is they want. I think one of the hardest things for me has been to be the parent of a guy, of my oldest son, who will forever be 7. He has the soul of a 28-year-old man. And therefore, he wants to be independent. He wants to drive and change the world. He doesn't want his parents to tell him what to do. And there's ways in which he is every bit of a 28-year-old man. And yet, he's got a 7-year-old mom. And that tension that he lives with is so difficult. We were working on his room the other day. A room can get messy when you never outgrow your toys and you're 28 years old and you like things that 8-year-olds get. So we were trying to redo his room and I was saying, son, we're going to make it a man room. We're going to make it more like a workshop in here than this sea of toys. And I came in his room when he wasn't there and I started clearing some stuff out. And nothing wrong with that. Except he has a 28-year-old soul that doesn't want his dad. And his 7-year-old words were, I feel so violated. Why have you done that to me? Sometimes what our kids long for, you need to become aware of that. It is incredibly helpful if you're going to be a good parent to help your kids get in touch with the difference between their longings and their strategies. Because often our strategies are wrong and our longings are godly. I want to feel special. I want to feel alive. I want to be loved. I want to be respected. I want to be... It's what we do with that kind of gets us in trouble. And so I guess the second thing I just wanted to say to you tonight was I wanted you to think about the idea of character and of thinking about the character of your kids, the character that they, the roles they play, and kind of think about those things.
Be sure to join us next month for the second part of our conversation with Jim Cofield. If you'd like more information, you can go to www.orangewood.org/letschat. There you can find more info on upcoming podcast episodes as well as some of our upcoming Let's Chat Live events if you're in the Orlando area. We'll see you then.